afternoon. So, last time we talked about the interface that kind of Unix systems have chosen for managing processes, well, part of that interface. And, oh, I forgot important thing here. Should have written on the slide. So we had fork was the way of creating a new process. And this was separate from the operation of running a new program. So fork created a new process. We need to know what to put in that process. We learn the process has these registers. It has the memory contents. Where do we get those from in fork? We just copy the current process that's calling fork. So we end up with two copies. And we need some way of telling which copy we're in. Yes? Oh. Right. Oh. Huh. And I see that I'm not projecting anything. That is wonderful. Okay. Turning it off and on again. You're excited. So we copy it twice, and we need some way of knowing which process we're in. We have these two processes that are otherwise identical, and well, they're not quite identical, and there's kind of two differences they have. They have different process IDs, which we learned were how we identify process for things like sending signals. And they also differ in what fork is going to return in each. So the fork call arranges that in the parent process, you get the PID of the new process. And in the child process, you get this zero, which is kind of like a null value for a process ID, just to indicate you're in the child. You don't have any new PIDs that you're to report. And because we sort of have these two processes that now exist after fork, they both are eligible to run. So whenever the system decides, I want to switch to some process and start running it, it can run either of them, especially if we have multiple cores. It can run them at the same time. It can run them taking turns. They're just like any other program we've started on the system in that respect. So we had this way of creating a new process, but they didn't let us run different programs, and that's kind of usually the big reason we're running a new process, is to run a different program. So we wanted to deal with running a different program, and the way we're going to do that is with exec. So exec takes the current program and replaces whatever program is running in the current process with a different program. Basically, it kind of loads something into your current process, sets all the registers and the contents of memory to whatever you want to do to start a new program. And when we run it, we kind of specify, here's the file I want you to load, and also here's how you should start it, so you need the contents of argv and things like that, that will be copied into the program's memory, so when it starts, it has its arguments and all that. And we have this sort of typical pattern we'd use where we fork, and then in the child process, we'd exec. Seems awfully wasteful because we're doing all this copying only to replace that whole thing we copied. We'll learn later on how that maybe isn't quite as bad. Still not good, but isn't quite as bad. And another step we needed is we wanted a way to wait for programs. So if we run a command in our shell and we say type ls, the shell doesn't print the next prompt until ls finishes. If you open up Vim or some other editor, the shell doesn't try to start asking you for more commands until whatever that your text editor that you started actually accepts, for example. So to enable that, we need some way of waiting for programs, and we have this call called waitPID, which will wait for programs to finish. And the way that works is that you have to run it from, so have to wait for a child process, meaning one that you started with fork. So if you're in a, if you want to wait for a program someone else started, too bad. Wait PID won't let you do it. You'll need to find another way. And it will give you the status, gives the status, which is going to tell you what was passed to xset, or, you know, if it crashed, and information about how, like, did it set fault, did it get control seed, and so on. So that's going to be encoded in that status. You can look up in the manual pages how to decode that. And we saw this typical pattern, and you're going to implement a version of this pattern in the lab on Wednesday, which is probably easier than a lab should be in this class, but I haven't changed it. Yeah.
Did you say that LS uses WakeID? And if so, like, how does it, where's the child?
The question, did I say LS uses WakeID? I say when you run LS, the program, your shell, which is the program you type commands into, uses WakeID to wait for LS to finish. So if we think of, like, we have our shell prompt, right, and we type ls, and then ls prints out stuff, and then we print another shell prompt. So if the shell doesn't wait, we've had this problem that the shell prompt could be printed out in the middle of ls's stuff. So the way it prevents that is that when it runs ls, it makes a new process, because it needs to keep running later on. In that new process is running, it gets uses exec to run ls in that process, and it waits for it to finish before it asks for more input. So we don't have the prompt printed out in the middle of your list of files. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? OK, so I mentioned things about labs. So more anonymous feedback stuff. So I feel like the feedback left for this class gets regarded. Students put a ton of time to write out issues they have in the class, which get skimmed over in seconds with a response like, students said the lab was too hard, I don't think so. So on that specific issue, I did quickly sort of mention feedback about the signals lab being too hard and go off it. The main reason for that is I can't really change the lab after the fact, and I didn't want to spend a lot of class time on it. Also, I wanted to talk to my TAs first about what was actually hard in the lab, and probably my plan for next semester is that I'm going to make that lab give students the show memory opening code, because I gather that probably was where there was the most time spent and not spent on signal stuff, which is what the lab is supposed to be about, that we could just avoid. But I agreed it was too long, but I'm not going to change it after the fact, and if I'm going to adjust grades, that's at the end of the semester, not now. As for other things, yes, I'm trying to manage class time. That's the main reason it feels like I rushed through feedback here. It's not because I don't pay attention to it or think about it more. And continuing with that, some complaints that are sort of broadly saying, you know, that you should deal with my students who have problems, yes. And this class, sort of complaints that are based on some notion that I'm not covering the bigger picture of concepts and going into in-depth examples. Before doing that, I can think about ways to adjust this. I would note for feedback of this sort, it's hard for this to be actionable for me. And the main reason why is often what I think is going over the bigger picture, you might disagree. Like, I might say, oh, I need to go over the bigger picture, so let's give sort of examples of what motivates people to use this, and you might say, oh, that's going into in-depth examples, that's not bigger picture. And I might make other mistakes like that that don't match your idea of what you want, so more specifics will help me figure out how I'm mismatching. If you want me to improve things in a particular direction, like examples of like what specifically was, you know, seemed like I was out there will help. Because I will make my best guesses and make slow revisions, especially over like the summer. But you know, I'm going to be making, I might have different opinions about how bigger picture or not focusing on edge cases, what that means, than you do. And then one on, I wish the quizzes opened earlier. I might be able to do this. The main reason the quizzes open at 9 p.m. when they do is that sometimes, probably like less than half of the weeks, I need to like make some substantial edit to the quiz after lecture, and I want to have enough time that I can have someone else look at that before I show it to you. But I could probably release them early on the caveat that that might not happen every week. And on another issue, I'm aware I'm behind on quiz 2 grade 8. I'm trying to try to figure out why that happened. Because there's definitely grading I expected to have happened that didn't. And on the quiz, let's talk about, yes, sorry. The question is, should you have to submit a regrade request to have a comment looked at? You should not. You are welcome to. We're not going to stop you. And after TAs do normal grading, which is supposed to be in a week, but apparently that didn't happen this time, I will look at regrade comments. So if you want an appeal, like after the TAs do the normal round of grading, which normally would be a week, but apparently not for quiz two, because I don't know what's happening, then I will look at them. Or you can email me for that. Okay, so on this week's quiz, I should talk about some things that happen on the question. So quiz question two sort of was asking about one program signal handler running from another running kill. So kill sends a signal, and the thing I want you to understand in this question is basically that they're still running in separate processes. So even though this kind of seems like a function call, it's not a function call. But after we call kill, our program keeps running in its own thread, meaning that it gets switched on and off the processor separately from the other one, even though we've made the other one move to a different function. So this means that the return address in the process that's running the signal handler, it's going to return back to doing whatever that process was doing before the signal happened. And the return address is going to enable that. It's not going to go back to another process. We can't do that because that's not even in the memory we have access to. Like, in the idea of a return address is that this is where the function jumps to when it exits. We can't jump to the other program. It's not even in our memory. We can't access it. And another was asking where temp was, and because the processes run independently, temp and one of the other functions, like that other signal handler can return while the one it triggered to run is running. The kill doesn't wait for the signal to be handled, it just sends the signal off, and the signal gets handled eventually, but it doesn't guarantee anything has happened before it returns. On question three, option B was asking in a sort of roundabout way, can process IDs be reused? And I neglected to realize until later that I didn't really cover this in lecture. So the answer is that they can. They can't be reused if you haven't waited for it yet, because otherwise wait PID can't work. But once you've waited for a process, or someone else has waited for the process, the PID is eligible to be reused. And this kind of has to be the case, because if you have a system like Portal that's like supposed to be up for months, hopefully, and the process ID is a 32-bit number, as it often is, we can run 2 billion processes over a few months, and we need to reuse numbers at some point. And then I should talk about question four, which I think had the most trouble. So in question four, we had this scenario where we had fork, and we had this other PID value, which was zero in the child process, and the child's PID in the parent. And things were set up. So sig user one in the child triggered sig user two in the parent, and sig user one in the parent triggered sig user two in the child. And they also, we had some code that initially triggered sig user one or user two. And we had this assumption in the question that the singles were handled one at a time, so we didn't need to worry about single handlers being nested and also some attendant single safety issues. This wasn't ensured by the given code, but we could have actually done that by changing how SA mask was set, but we didn't cover that in the lecture. And most of these were not possible, and I'll talk about, sort of mention briefly why, since there was definitely a lot of confusion on this. So in the SIG user 2 handler, it exited after handling things. Well, this is, I guess, that's not the, so the first scenario, we have the SIG user 2 handler for the child running, but it's supposed to be triggered by the parent unless we have someone else running it, which I just hope you assume wasn't happening, given there's no real-time window to do that. So that doesn't make sense. Didn't make sense for that reason. That this, you know, needs 43 SIG user 1 first. In the B scenario, we have someone SIG user 1 running after SIG user 2, but the SIG user 2 handler exits. So the program can't keep running. In C, we have three different values for other PID, but it's assigned once and there's two processes running, so it can only have two values. 43, 44, and 0. And in D, we have the child getting SIG user 2 without the parents sending it that signal. Questions on these? Yes?
What happens if the parent receives a signal before it exits, but after it prints?
What happens if the parent receives a signal before it exits and after it prints? So, in that case, the signal handler could run in the middle. In the question, we have this assumption that signal handlers don't run while another signal handler is running. And that prevents that because the exit would happen before the signal handler returns. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, if two signals are sent to the same process, the first one sent will always be received first no matter what? No, the order is indeterminate. If they're both, if they're both sent and not received yet. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is that why this question had like a disclaimer?
Is that why this question had the assumption? That is part of why, yes. It's to avoid, it was mainly actually to avoid sort of what if the signal is received in the middle of another signal handler and the prints are out of order because of that, wanted to not even think about that problem. Yeah.
So if you swap like MD, the middle two statements, would that be valid?
If I swap these two, would that be valid? I believe so, yes. Other questions? And then question 6, we had some code and we were asking how many processes could be running simultaneously. And here's my diagram for what goes on in the relevant part of the code. So we run PID 1 equals fork. This creates a child process. In that child process, we do PID 2 equals fork. And that creates a child of a child process. And we have global plus equals 1 and the print at the bottom because we just keep going. We don't stop at the end of the if-else statement unless there's an exit or something. And also we had this global plus equals 2 and a wait PID. And this is the moment where we can have three things running. And I guess I had some questions about, wait, if someone's waiting, are they not running? And that is indeed something I should have defined better, but it doesn't change the answer because we don't know how long it's going to take the original process to set up the wait PID because they're running at different speeds. We could context switch away from the first process and then context switch back to it. So we don't have any guarantee that the wait PID even starts in time for the other processes not to get there. Yeah.
So the three processes running are the original process.
So the PID one, process that's in PID 1 and the process that's in PID 2 here. And because we have a wait PID for PID 1, we don't have to worry about, we don't have an additional child forked at the same time. We will have one later, but it can't be running simultaneously with those first two spawned programs or processes. Does that answer a question? Yeah. Other questions? Yeah. Go back to question two. Yeah.
For interchoice D, then, are we saying that it's incorrect because it's possible that tab isn't stored anywhere anymore because the process is exited?
So question D, am I saying it isn't correct because it's possible temp isn't stored anywhere because the process is exited? Not because the process is exited, but because the signal handler has returned.
Okay.
So it's gone out of scope.
I see.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, other questions? Okay. Yeah, sorry, this one. That's not the correct answer. That's the ones the slide's about.
Oh, okay.
Other questions? Okay. So we're going to talk about some other things with the process API. We're going to talk about how it interacts with files. And kind of a motivation for this is that there's some features of the command line that we kind of haven't explained that you guys know how to do. So some of these are straightforward. So I'll start with this first one of searching for programs. So if you notice when we've seen examples of execv, that we provide the path to the program, but when you're running commands in the shell, you don't do that. You type ls, you don't type slash bin ls or slash user bin ls. So there's something where we search for programs in some system-defined locations. So that's actually fairly straightforward. Basically, we have a loop that checks all these locations. There's also another feature of running in the background, which I'm not sure, do we cover this in CSO1? Yes? No? No, okay. So if you run a command with an ampersand in your shell, rather than waiting for it to finish, the shell will just print another command prompt and let the program keep running. And if the program tries to get input, the shell will set things up so that won't work, basically. And there's some way of moving it back to the foreground. You can look up how the shell works for that. But basically, running in the background, the sort of principal mechanism there is it just doesn't wait for it. You don't wait for it, it just keeps running. That's what that does. So these features we know how to implement. And there are two other features we're going to focus on. One of them is redirection, which I think you've used in CSO1. Yes? No? No? Okay. So, talk about redirection. So, in your shell, in your, the command line, on Linux-like systems, you can specify this greater than sign and a file. And that's going to send the output of the program to that file, rather than to your terminal. And you can specify this less than sign and a file. And that's going to have the program read from input.txt, in this case, that file we specified, rather than reading from the terminal. So it's, when it tries to read from the terminal, instead it will get stuff from input.txt. So these are ways where we run a program, but we change what its standard in and standard out are. And as an extension of that, shells also support this thing called pipelines, where we specify this pipe character that you might know as the bitwise OR operator in C. And this is kind of an extension of that where we're changing the input and output of these programs. In this case, we're making some program, in my example, that first program, we're making its output go as the input to some filter. So we connect these two programs together. So we're going to talk about how to implement these features and what sort of interface is provided for that as kind of our first topic for today. So questions about what sort of these features do? Yeah?
The pipeline, is the left side the input or the output?
Question for the pipeline, is the left side the input or the output? the data goes in this in the left to right direction. Yes?
So I'm assuming that for the pipeline, the second program runs once the first one terminates?
For the pipeline, the second program runs when the first one terminates? No, they both run at the same time. So as the first program is producing output, the second program is reading that output. And there was a question back there? Yeah. Question, is this direct, in the case of the pipeline, is it directly standard out and standard in?
Yeah, for redirection.
For redirection pipeline, yes. This is, we're gonna change the standard out and standard in for these programs when we run them with this. Yeah. Question, is it possible to put the program's output into output.txt and send it to another program, you're asking? Not with the, so yes, but not as a thing that there's a consistent way of doing it across shells and implementing it. We're not going to talk about tools for implementing it that aren't a little awkward. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So in redirection, do we still need F and F, but like specified standard out, but then it would just send it to the TXT file?
So in redirection, does the program, question, do you still use the same output functions? Yes, so as far as the programs are concerned that we're doing this redirection or pipelining on, they don't change. They're written as if they're using a terminal, and when we run them without a terminal and they just run the same code and it gets input and output, gets input from different places and sends output to different places. Yes?
So two quick questions. So if output.txt doesn't exist, will this make one?
Question, if output.txt doesn't exist, will this make one? Yes. And also if output.txt does exist, it will truncate it. It will, if there's already stuff in output.txt, will it just clear it out? Yes. If you don't want to do that, you can do double greater than to append. Okay, so let's, we're going to talk about how this works. So let's talk about how files work in sort of the Unix design. So in the Unix design, we have, with every process, we have to track some information about it, and part of that information is what files it has opened. So we have some struct, and we have an array of what the POSIX standard calls open file descriptions. And we have to index into this array to access files the program has opened. So when you open a file, it puts something in this array, it sets a pointer in this array, and when you're using system calls directly, you access this array by specifying an index, which we call a file descriptor. So that's what the system calls use. If you use standard A.h, the file stars are kind of abstracting this for you. So the file stars like points to a struct that has a file descriptor and some extra information for the standard I.O. functions to work, usually including a buffer of things they haven't written yet, or you haven't read, they've read from the system but haven't given to you yet. So if the system calls are all dealing with these file descriptors, which are just array indices, you might wonder, so what's standard out and standard in then? And the answer is that we've just had this convention that certain indices are standard in and standard out and standard in. So when you try to write to standard out, you're actually trying to write to file descriptor 1. When you try to write to standard error, file descriptor 2. When you try to read from standard in, you're reading from file descriptor 0. And that means if we just set up that sort of array index of your files to point to whatever file we want, that's how we implement that redirection. And we're going to do something similar to implement those pipelines. We're going to basically set up your standard out to point to something that will go to another program standard in. And you could memorize these numbers. There's constants for them. in unistandard.h, so you don't have to, and I will try to use them on my examples because I think it's clearer. So we have these file descriptors, you know, these indexes into this array, and these sort of pointers to information about a file. So how do we get file descriptors? Well, they're what open and related functions assign. So open a file, and this open sort of represents sort of, I should say, this open is the system call wrapper typically. So there's an open system call, and you probably typically use fopen or like Python's open function, and that internally makes this system call on a Linux system, which is a file descriptor. And also, there's other sort of function calls which give you files, because the term file in the Unix world is very vast. So something you might have noticed that I kind of glossed over is that I said, you know, standard out's a file, but it's often a terminal. Terminals are files. And you've used sockets a little bit in CSO1, at least most of you, those are also files and have file descriptors. And in fact, when you wrote socket code in CSO1, you were using file descriptors. That's what socket returns, is a file descriptor. And basically every other sort of thing you send read and write to is a file. Yes?
Could you mention that file descriptors can be considered indices and an array?
Yeah.
What is that array?
That's an array that's kept somewhere inside the kernel, the sort of core OS code that's running all the time. For every process, it tracks this array, which has pointers to the actual information about the file. You know, the information it needs to implement read and write operations. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And also, I guess in the lab, we saw shared memory, SHAM open, also gives us a file descriptor that's had. So it's a way of referring to an open file. So, question, yes? So the question is, what are these O read only, O rewrite? Is that sort of something like chmod style permissions? It's something similar. These have numbers that are designed to be ORed together to specify how you want to open the file. And I've only shown sort of reading, writing, or reading and writing. There's also support for things like, do you want to append or not? Do you want to create the file that doesn't exist, and so on? Which is why you combine them together. Does that answer your question? Okay, so we've talked about opening files. We also need to close files. And there's a close sort of system call wrapper that takes a file descriptor and closes it. And this is going to be a point of confusion for reasons we'll see later. So you should think of this function as basically equivalent to setting some index in that array to null. And as we'll see later, it turns out we can have multiple file descriptors that all point to the same open file description. So closing just deallocates one of them, and if it's the last one for that open file, then it actually sort of releases the resources for that. If not, you can still access it if there's any other file descriptors that refer to it. We'll see later how can we have two file descriptors for the same open file. That's going to come up a lot when we're implementing things like redirection. Yes?
Are file descriptors 0, 1, and 2 put inside that array, or does the OS not do that?
Question, are file descriptors 0, 1, and 2 put inside that array? Yes. So as far as the OS is concerned, there's nothing special about standard in, standard out, and standard error. They're just another thing in this array. Does that answer your question? Question, when you do redirection, is it meant to overwrite the file or does append to it? So the redirection I showed here overwrites it. There's a way with two greater than signs to append to it. And we'll see in the implementation, it's going to churn out that the shell is making an open call like this, and it can change the open call to change that behavior. Yes? So the question is, what happens if I run close on standard out and standard in? So if I run close of 0, 1, well, then when you try to use, something tries to use those file descriptors, immediately afterwards, they won't work anymore. So the reads and writes will fail. If you open files later on, they might be assigned number 0 or number 1, in which case they'll start becoming your standard in or standard out just because you opened them and didn't pay attention to what number they got assigned. Yeah?
Does the knowledge prevent me from doing that? Can I do it just to, like, get some?
Can you, does the OS prevent you from doing that, meaning closing standard in, standard out, or opening something up and having it become standard in or standard out? Nope. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about sort of how we're going to implement redirect. And kind of a key thing that's going to make it work is that when we run exec, I said it like loads a new program, but it doesn't load new file descriptors. So that array of what the open files are doesn't change. So we're going to take advantage of that to edit that array before we call exec. So, and how this is going to work is that we're going to call fork, and after forking, we're going to have two arrays of open file descriptions that point to the same open files. So we have two pointers in different for the different processes that point to the same open files. That's what fork does. And if we want to redirect one of them, we're going to change the pointer in the new process to point to some other file. And notice, because we have separate pointers, doing this isn't going to disrupt the original process. So our shell can do this redirection and still output to the terminal with its standard out. It doesn't need to change anything about that because all the changes it's doing in this new child process before it runs exec. And so that's going to give us a pattern where in our child process, we're going to do this extra work before exec happens of opening these files for redirection and setting them up as standard in, standard out, et cetera. Okay, some questions about this idea? So a step we seem to be missing here is how do I do this operation of kind of overriding where FD1 points to point to somewhere else? So one way we could do this is by closing file descriptor 1, standard out, and hoping that when we open something, it becomes file descriptor 1. And this is a viable strategy, it turns out, because file descriptors are assigned lowest first. But we're going to have a, you know, generally better way of doing that, in that there's going to be a system call explicitly for reassigning file descriptors. And that system call is going to have a system call wrapper dupe2. And it's basically doing this assignment, that it takes the pointer from one part of the array and copies it to another. So now we have two file descriptors that both point to the same open file. So if we're thinking of our redirection case, we're going to open our file, which is, say, going to be sort of output.txt, and we want to make it become standard out. We can do that with this dupe2 call, where we pass the file descriptor we got from open and standard out, and it's going to overwrite where standard out points. And in the process, it's also going to handle making sure it doesn't leak memory and all that stuff if, you know, we need to free up some stuff for the original thing standard out was pointing to. So questions about this dupe to operation? So our kind of steps for implementing this redirection are we open output by text to get a new file descriptor, and we make that file descriptor standard out with dupe to. And dupe to handles all the cases of what if the new thing file descriptor we want for that file is already there. It's going to let it overwrite it, take care of getting rid of the old one, and so on. Yes?
So, sorry, functionally, what does that do? So if, so the index in the process array that was pointing to output.txt is now pointing to standard.out?
Question, the input in the process array that was pointing to output.txt is now pointing to standard.out? So the index that corresponds to standard out now points to the same place that the one that pointed to output.txt pointed, meaning they both point to output.txt. So if we think of our array, let's say we initially had like 0 pointed to the terminal, 1 pointed to the terminal, 2 pointed to the terminal, and we had, say, 3 pointed to output.txt. If we run dupe 2 of 3, 2, we're going to take what 3 points to, which is output.txt, and we're going to make 2, I guess I should do, yeah, we're going to, in that case, we're going to make 2 also point there. That's what dupe to 3, 2 would do. And then typically, for this redirection, we're going to have our second argument be the standard out file descriptor, which is 1. So standard out now points to output.txt, 2. And as we'll see in some examples, after we do this, we can actually close, in this example, 3, because we have another pointer to output.txt that will still be there after we close 3, because close just zeros out that one pointer. And so I have an example of that here. Yes. So the question is, if I change output.txt to standard out to point to output.txt, if that program spawns child processes, do they still go to output.txt? Absolutely. And if we only want to change this for one process, we should make that. So if we only want to change this for a process we make, we should make the change in the child process, not the original process. So question, if we close standard out after doing this, does it get restored to its old value? No. Yeah.
How is the file descriptor reset after the program is closed?
Question, how is the file descriptor reset after the program is closed in the case of redirection? So the key reason that that doesn't cause a problem is that we're only redirecting in the child. So the parent process, the one that's running the shell, it doesn't change where its standard out is at any point. And so that means that when the shell decides to run the next program, if it doesn't do this redirection again, the standard out is still pointing in the old place because it never changed in the original process. It only changed in the new process. Yes?
So the file descriptors are separate from each process?
So the file descriptors are separate for each process? Yes. So each process has its own array pointing to these open files. Other questions? Yeah.
So for every example, we have to generate like fork a new child process based on all our shared content.
Question, for every command we run, we have to fork a new child process. This is typically what we will end up doing because we want the option of waiting for the program or continuing our program afterwards. In the sort of exceptional case where we don't care about our program continuing to run after that other program finishes, we could just do just exec without forking, but that's not very common. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So here I have an example of redirecting standard out. So, and I'm trying to work with standard IO to H. So first I tell standard IO to H with fflush, hey, anything you were about to put to standard out but haven't yet, please output it because I'm about to mess it up. And then I open a file and I'm gonna get a new file description, descriptor for it. And if that works, I reassign that. So now both the new file descriptor and standard out point to the same file. And once I've done that, I can actually close the original file descriptor. And all I'm doing, so we think of our file descriptions. We have our standard in points to like the terminal, and standard out initially say points to the terminal. And we have say our new file descriptor that points to output.txt. And when I call this dupe2, I'm making it point to, sorry, that's not the correction. When I call dupe2, I'm changing standard out to no longer point to the terminal, but to point to output.txt. And then I close file descriptor, and that's going to make fd point to null, basically. Because it doesn't change where standard out points, so standard out still goes to output.txt, which is, means that in this example, this printf down here will go to output.txt. Yes? Question, does the print overwrite or append to output.txt? In this case, it overwrites it because I specified otrunc, which means truncate. Cut output.txt short and start at the beginning. If I didn't want that to happen, I could have instead specify oappend and not specified otruncate. Yeah? Question, in order to append the file properly, I have to include truncate. I have to include append, I have to not include truncate, but include some, and include something like oappend, yes. Or alternately, I could use seek to the end of the file after opening it, which is almost the same as specifying append. Not quite in some corner cases, but almost the same. Yeah. Question, when I do the redirection, does that automatically make the file standard out? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you're doing redirection with like one greater than, so doing this, and then with two greater than, it's like
O underscore. Question, when I'm doing redirection with one greater than, it's doing an open like this, and it's doing it with O append instead of a truncate or something similar. When I do two greater than, yes. And yeah. Your question? Yeah. Question, if you don't close the original file, does anything happen? So in that case, it's still going to be open when if you would execute a new program. And the size of that array is limited. So this could get you into trouble primarily from sort of running out of resources if you do this all the time. And secondarily, there's some cases where it matters for things like sockets. Like it matters if the socket is still open by anyone or not, and having this still be open means that like, if this was a socket and not a normal file, like the connection wouldn't close automatically like you might expect. Does that answer your question? Yeah, question? Other questions? Okay, so we have these redirection sort of operators we see. So we see open sort of assigns an entry in this array. Dupe2 is our copy one entry to another. Close nulls out an entry. And forking just copies all the pointers. So we're pointing to the same stuff. And this redirection sort of I showed kind of, so sort of this is, I showed our redirect standard out code, and I mentioned to make this work in that shell context, we're gonna run this in the child process, sort of after we fork, before we exec. So we only affect the new program we're running, not any other programs. And you should be able to extend this to handle the input case. We're gonna open a file for reading, not writing, and change it to standard in, not standard out. But I haven't dealt with how we do the other shell operation, these pipelines. So for pipelines, we're gonna use the same ideas for redirection that we can set the standard out and standard in to other files, but we need some sort of file that instead of going somewhere to be stored on disk, ends up going to the other program. And Unix systems helpfully provide a special type of file for that. You can, it's sort of how it works is kind of similar to a socket. They're called pipes, but basically you write in one end and it comes out the other, and the pipe is gonna have two ends to make this happen. And you can create it with the pipe library call, which we'll see later. And by having two ends, I mean we're gonna get two file descriptors, so one of which represents the read end of the pipe, and one of which represents the write end of the pipe. The pipes are gonna be unidirectional, so that's unlike sockets in that way, but you can kind of think of the, if you remember how sockets worked, which some of you do and some of you don't, is my impression from CS01, they're basically like a one-directional socket that's already connected. So kind of the way this works is that you call this pipe function and it takes an array of two file descriptors. So it allocates two file descriptors, it fills in the array with those two ones. It also returns an error code to say like if it's out of memory, because you know, don't want to always work. And index one in the array is the write end of the pipe, index zero is the read end, and we can use sort of the system calls that write to the write end and that read from the read end, you know, and this is also things you could do less directly with like printf and so on, as would happen when we have those pipelines. Like as long as the file descriptor is created with this pipe, we'll go in one of these ends and come out the other. And typically, we're gonna use this with multiple processes. So you might say, wait a moment, if I'm getting both ends of the pipe at once, how do they end up in two different processes? And the answer to that is gonna be fork. That because fork copies this table of pointers to open files, if we call pipe and then fork, we have now two programs that point to the same pipe, and therefore can access the same pipe. And that's how the shell is gonna set up so one program can talk to another, that before it runs either of those programs, it's gonna create a pipe, so it's around when it wants to exec either of them, it can set them up as standard in or standard out. So I'll give kind of a simple example of sort of how pipes work with, you know, just a, two processes involved. But if we think of the shell case, it actually involves at least three, as we'll see on the next slide. So in this example, I have a program running, I call fork, and I'm gonna run two programs, and our child is gonna write, and our parent is gonna read. And the idea is that we're gonna set this up so when our child writes, our parent reads the results. So to make that happen, we're gonna call pipe before we fork, so we have a pipe that, we have file descriptors that are available for both, and we're going to keep the write end of the pipe in the child, so you see we close the read end because we don't care about it anymore, and we're gonna keep the read end of the pipe in the parent. We're gonna close the right end because we don't care about it anymore. And actually, it's fairly important that we close the right end, you know, Because this makes sure we can detect end of input. If we don't close this, if we ask, can I read more from this pipe? This OS will say, let me wait to see if there's more coming on the pipe. Because someone could write to it that someone is us. You might say that's stupid. It is, but that's the rule is basically if anyone has the right end open, reading will wait for more input, even if it's not possible to get. And that gets to another issue that's something about pipes that's different than if we just made a temporary file. So unlike a temporary file, if let's say we're writing to the pipe and the parent process doesn't keep up in reading, what's going to happen is those writes will hang until the parent catches up some. The OS will only have a limited amount of data it will keep around that has been written but not read yet, rather than letting it sort of take up all your space like a temporary file might. Yes?
Instead of initiating read FD and write FD before each process and then closing the other one at the beginning of each process, why can't we just start, initiate write FD in child process and initiate read FD in the parent process?
So the question is, why did we have to do this setup before fork? So if we call pipe afterwards, each call to pipe is going to give us a separate new pipe. And so if we called it in both the parent and the child, we'd have two separate pipes that are unrelated to each other. So writing to one, we couldn't read from the other because they were created with different calls to pipe. So in order for them to actually be connected, we have to have there be exactly one call to pipe. And doing it before fork lets us have exactly one call to pipe. Otherwise, we have two independent pipes, kind of like two separate files that, like, if you write to one, it doesn't change anything about the other. Line 3 and 4, what lines are we talking about? These lines?
Yes.
So these are before the fork. It wouldn't change anything if they were afterwards because they're just me getting a shorthand to not write pipe FD of 0 and pipe FD of 1.
Okay, I'm just saying if we initiate it within the child and parent process, then we don't need to worry about closing the other one, right?
Question, if we move those assignments of read FD and write FD to the ifs and else statements, we don't have to worry about closing. That is not correct. Pipe opens these two file descriptors regardless of what names we give for them. So once we've called pipe, we have two file descriptors open, and if we want to have the other closed, we have to close it somewhere. Yeah?
Do you as a developer have to make sure that this always happens in the right order, that like the write's done before the read's let happen, or does the OS take care of that?
Question, do you have to make sure the write's done before the read happens? No, the OS takes care of it. So if you read before something's written, the read will just wait. And this is why you can just run programs that don't expect to be using pipes with pipes, and they'll just work because as far as they're concerned, it's like someone's slow to type in to the keyboard. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Does pipe FD have to be
size 2? Yes. Cannot be larger. So if we think of what the shell typically does with pipes, so here we have an example command that you might run in the shell where we're running ls with an argument and taking its output, and rather than displaying it on the terminal, I'm running it through the grep command, which searches its input for some string, in this case foo. So I'm running ls to get a list of files and searching that list of files for the file foo, or files containing foo in their name. And you see the setup I did here is I create my pair of read and write ends of the pipe before I call fork. Then I assign the write end to be standard out before running ls. And I also close both of the original file descriptors. Note that this doesn't close standard out because standard out points is a separate pointer. We're just getting rid of the extra pointers we don't need anymore to the pipe. And then I run ls. And for grep, I take the read end of the pipe and assign it to standard in, close the extra pointers to the pipe that I got from that I don't need anymore, and then run grep. And then I also close the extra pointers to the pipe I don't need anymore in the original process, and if this was a shell, we'd then start waiting for ls and grep with wait PID. Questions about how this code works? Yeah.
So would you be able to close the parts that you don't use as soon as you got four? Like as in, okay, I know I'm on a child process, and at the child process, I only want to write. So I can just close file descriptors here.
Question, could I close the file descriptors earlier? Then I do, yes, I could close them up. I could close pipe, the one I'm not gonna use earlier. It doesn't really matter as long as I close it before exec. If I don't close it before exec, I can't ever close it because remember exec doesn't return. Other questions? Yeah. Why are we using a special type of file instead of reading and writing to a file? So the primary, I guess there's two reasons to do this. So one is we want it to be the case that when a program reads, it's going to wait for more output, which won't happen with a normal file. In a normal file, if you reach the end of the file and you read, it will say you're at the end of the file. We want the program to instead see, oh, this ls program might have more info for you later and have it wait. And the pipes will do that. The other reason is that let's say we're running programs that produce a lot of outputs. So ls minus one probably doesn't, but if we have programs that produce a lot of output, we want to not store all of that output, and pipes will not do that. So after you've read something from a pipe, the OS can stop storing it for you, which wouldn't happen if we used a normal temporary file. That answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, if we don't close the read end of the pipe, we'll just be wasting space? Yes. So with the write of the pipe, it's a bit worse because we'll be making someone who reads from the pipe think that there might be more data still. Other questions? Okay. And I can kind of show. What happened in this example. So let's say we call pipe, and it gives us an array with 3 and 4, our read and write end. We can think of, we spawn two childs. The first one, we assign, say, our write end 4 to standard out, and then close 3 and 4. And the second child, we assign our read end 3 to standard in, and then close 3 and 4. And in exec, ls, and grep, respectively. And in the parent, we close 3 and 4. Because after we spawn the child processes, we don't need to deal with the pipe ourselves anymore. That's all going to be done in these new processes we create. Okay, so let's do a little exercise with pipe. And I'm using sort of the raw system call for write and read. So the arguments to write and read are write or read, and we have a file descriptor, so that's an index into that array. We have a buffer with the bytes to read or write, and the size. So the bytes to read into or write from, and the size of that buffer. I'll write size of buffer. And this is the sort of raw system call. This is how printf is implemented by calling this write or read function. Write function or scanf is implemented by calling the read function. Who would like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, any volunteers with things that might be causing this phenomenon? Yeah. Is it because we fork before we call pipe? So that is indeed the biggest cause of this problem here. And the reason what's happening is that if we think of our programs, we fork and we call pipe twice, so we have two pipes. So we have one in the parent and one in the child. And if we think of our child process, we get pipe with a sort of a write and a read. So the write of WC, write out of the child, read in from the child. We close the read end of the child, and then we try to write to the write end of the child. And that's supposed to go to the read end of the child, which isn't opened by anyone. So that's not going to go anywhere useful. And it turns out, actually, that the default behavior, I believe, is that this will trigger, I think it's sigpipe, which will often result in the message broken pipe, or it will return an error, depending on exactly how things are set up. Because we're writing to a pipe that has no one who can read from it ever. Yeah. So we'll get to, so you're saying, isn't another thing, if we fix where the pipe is created, isn't another cause of this problem that the parent could read earlier? We'll get to that in a second. So let's talk about what's happening in our parent. So we have a separate pipe in our parent with a, where we're closing the write end and reading from the read end. And because there's no one who can write to the pipe, the read is going to return zero, which is how read indicates end of file. So that is actually the defined behavior. So I'll get to the question of couldn't this still happen if I fix this by moving this up and the parent read first? And we'll get to that question later, but before I get to that, questions about this scenario as it is. Okay, so on the question of if I fixed where the pipe call is, so we only have one pipe, so the parent and child actually are connected to each other, could this still happen? And it turns out that the answer is no because of how read works on pipes. So read will always wait, I guess not always, read unless you set some settings explicitly otherwise, which we're not doing in this code because we're using the default settings for the pipe, we haven't configured anything differently, will always wait until it reads at least one byte before it returns, unless we're at end of file, unless there's no more input. So it's not actually possible because the pipe will know, in this case, that until the child writes, the pipe knows there could be more input and it will wait. And we haven't tried to turn off that behavior by making some other system calls that you can look up or I can tell you about if you want to ask. And this is important because if we didn't do this, then it wouldn't work very well for the pipelining idea and shell commands, because then we have programs sort of randomly think they got end of file when they shouldn't have. Yes?
Do you have to close the write file descriptor at the end of the child before you exit?
Do I have to close the write file descriptor at the end of the child before I exit? No, because exiting a process closes all your file descriptors. Other questions? Yeah. The question is, if I left the write pipe open, does that mean the read pipe will be waiting because it's not closed? So the read could return as long as it has something to return, but if we write again, it would wait indefinitely. Basically, read waits until it has at least one byte to return, and then it might return. Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's kind of on pipe and redirection. And that concludes what we're talking about on processes, and also is enough to do the homework for next week. And we'll, so it's exclusive of the process API, so next we'll talk about the memory part of processes, how that's implemented in more detail as kind of our, one of our big topics this semester.